You're listening to Fakeologist Radio Conference Call, another Fakeologist service to connect like-minded skeptics who want to share their ideas with like-minded individuals. Unlike audio chat, all you need is a telephone, whether it be a hard line or a soft line like Skype. Go to fakeologist.com/CC and learn how to participate or start a call. And hear it later on fakeologist.com. To comment on this call, find the post at audiochat.fakeologist.com and scroll through the archives. Now, on with the call.
Welcome, everyone, to the fakeologist.com conference call. This is a free service that we offer for those that choose not to use their computers or internet or smartphones or otherwise. You can call in using a plain old dumb phone. You know, the old things that Alexander Graham Bell invented? Just dial in to one of the access numbers, no matter what country you're in around the wide world. Go to fakeologist.com/CC, Charlie Charlie, and you'll find a list of all the numbers that you can dial in on. And today, we have two guests. Hopefully, they will make it. We've got John Adams, of course, for whom we found this service and decided to use it because he is mobile on the telephone. And today we might have Unreal join us from Paris, France. If you can dial in, that would be fantastic. And we'll all chat about whatever comes to mind that is fakeologist-related on this telephone. So we'll just stand by and hope they come by shortly. In the meantime, remember, we've got audiochat.fakeologist.com. We got chat.fakeologist.com. We got the main website, fakeologist.com. Audio chat's been pretty busy lately. Lots of participants, but we're still looking for new recruits. Anyone that has not chatted before, we want you to call in and tell us your 9/11 story. Or if that doesn't catch your fancy, let's talk about any media fakery of the day. The biggest fakery machine at the moment, probably in the history of modern man, has been NASA. Never a straight answer. Their main gift to us is the ISS or imaginary spaceship or international fake station or whatever you want the ISS acronym to stand for. There's some creative ones, and they supply propaganda fake stories every single day of the year and have been since they were created. And now it seems they're in hyperdrive, and I've been enjoying that. And maybe John Adams will speak to it, or Unreal will speak a little more. I did speak to Unreal on the regular audio chat using TeamSpeak earlier today, and I will be posting that as well tomorrow, September the 17th, 2015, the year of our Lord.
Steve Razzazzini.
John Adams, how are you, my friend?
Doing well, sir. How are you today?
Fantastic. I already made the introduction in anticipation of your arrival because I had nothing better to do. So that's out of the way. Everyone knows who you are. Everyone enjoys your chat. And to what name did you use? What pseudonym did you use just now introducing yourself?
I use Steve Razzazzini. Steve Razzazzini. That's what I use.
Who is that man?
He is a comedian who I'm sure anybody who's done a little bit of 9/11 fakery research knows the story of his escape from the Twin Towers, and I was actually hip to this just prior to seeing on fakeologist.com that he admitted to lying about that story. So I thought that was pretty funny considering how long someone like yourself and Chris and Marcus and the rest have been talking about people lying about their 9/11 stories.
Well, he did himself a favor for me because I've never heard of him in my entire life. Not that I'm going to look into him any further than this, but I suppose if he was languishing in obscurity, this may help him a little bit, at least get him looked up a few times on the YouTube.
Yeah, I had heard. I don't know every story under the sun about the 9/11 celebrity stories. This is one guy that I actually had heard of, his particular story, and I don't remember how I came across that, but I do remember this particular individual story, so that is pretty funny.
Are you familiar with his comedy? Is he funny?
I'm not.
Way?
No, I have no idea. The only funny thing I know about him is that he's likes to tell tall tales. Apparently.
Yeah, my post question: how many more of the 300 plus now celebutards that had a 9/11 close call? How many
right.
more will reveal that they didn't really have a close call?
Well, here's something Chris and I were talking about earlier today on my lunch break. And this was actually brought up. I started rolling this around in my head. This was actually brought up if anybody goes and listens to Chris talk about media fakery when this past September 11th, this last Friday, he was on the Republic Broadcasting Network with Clint Richardson on the Corporation Nation radio show.
It's on my list. I haven't heard, so I can't speak to it, but, yeah, I'm going to listen.
Okay, so Clint Richardson or one of the callers, I can't remember, they brought up how a lot of times when they bring out, like truthers or, you know, people who you're supposed to look to as some sort of, you know, guiding hand, a lot of times in the modern days, they're, like, comedians, right? Like Russell Brand, and you know what I'm talking about, right? Or Bill Maher.
Yeah. Why do we need funny guys to talk about serious subjects?
I don't know.
Is that really serious?
Yeah, that's the other interesting thing. And then I also started thinking about how there's a lot of comedians involved with this this type of stuff as well. Like, remember that time I sent you that clip of and you put a great little caption up there when you posted it on Fakeologist was Seth MacFarlane when he was on that talk show, and you said, look to your left for your lie, Seth.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I was told that people look to their left when they're lying. I don't know,
yeah.
Maybe lies are on the right side of the brain, or I don't know. They're up there somewhere.
Well, he's another funny guy who had a ridiculous 9/11 story of how he got drunk the night before, and getting drunk actually saved his life because he missed his plane. You know, he missed.
Right. So he missed his imaginary plane.
Yes.
Yeah,
so
his imaginary story and his imaginary drink.
So he actually has succeeded in making me laugh. That's for sure.
Yeah, he's we're told he's the creator of the Family Guy, or he's the front man for the Family Guy propaganda device, which is known
yes.
as a cartoon, where you're supposed to let your guard down and they might propagate serious issues, but because it's a cartoon, we wouldn't take it seriously, and it goes directly in our submission us to, if it did ever happen, then we knew we might take it less seriously, because it was in a cartoon first, and that's where it resides in our brains.
Yeah, it's pretty, like I said, Family Guy has Seth MacFarlane, he has an uncanny knack for predicting lots of things in those particular cartoons. So he's just lucky, or he's psychic, or the stuff is fake.
Or he's pre-scripted. It's a pre-script, like any other script. It's got to get shopped around, tested. I think there's probably a million scripts that get shopped around and tested before they go live, because many of them probably just fall flat on their faces, get no response. And perhaps that's a possibility. But, yeah, I think without sarcasm, we need to make it clear to people that scripts are preconditioning for what are portrayed as real events down the road, and none of this happens by accident, nothing at all. Everything is carefully laid out, carefully vetted, and carefully timed down to the day, the hour. Nothing is left to chance when it comes to the media, no matter if it's a humorist, an alleged comedy show, a cartoon. It's all there by strict design. There's no accident.
That's true. They just can't seem to hire very good actors to actually pull it off. Unfortunately, the public is – I've heard this bantied around a little bit, and I think I agree with it to a certain extent, and to a certain extent I think a lot of it is contrived as well, but people are so used to bad acting on TV and in movies that they don't even recognize a bad actor. That may be a possibility.
Well, not only that, but why do they need good actors? All media events are like firecrackers. They blow off, They fizzle out in minutes. They're off. They have their desired effect, and they're out of your consciousness in a 24-hour news cycle. Anything else that follows up are dribs and drabs, little drips, and nobody's paying attention anyway. Why would you invest? Why would you invest in a high-quality actor? It doesn't make any sense. There's a huge pool of A, B, and C actors out there that are waiting tables. So any scrap thrown their way is good enough. It doesn't even matter what they're doing.
That's definitely true.
Doesn't probably look too good on the resume, but or, you know, maybe acting is harder than we think. Maybe Tom Cruise is worth all his money. I don't know. I've never acted, but...
Yeah, you might reconsider that after seeing Cocktail.
Yeah, that's got some good music, doesn't it? That's got, what is it, that Beach Boys song in it.
Kokomo,
that's it. Yep. And he dances around. That's where he practiced dancing for Oprah, isn't it? He's dancing around that bar. Did he jump on the bar and start doing dirty dancing, or I don't know?
It's been quite a while since I've seen that movie.
It's pretty much impossible to enjoy a movie now unless it's some kind of realistic documentary. If there's such a thing, I don't know. I'm so desensitized to the bullshit.
So, what's been going on with you since we spoke last?
Oh, what hasn't been going on? My goodness, it's the audio chat's been going wild. I'm really enjoying, of course, Chris's output is just prodigious. It's really hard to keep up. He's a one-man media fakery exposure machine, and he can hardly keep up with his audios, his videos, his interviews, and his man on the street, which I encouraged. From my camp anyway, I said, I really enjoy Man on the Street. Your deadpan humor would probably be great. And he didn't disappoint with his visit to the Lawton, Oklahoma family picnic with the local thuggery. I didn't think you had to be a beefcake to be a cop. I thought that was discriminatory. I thought anyone of any size, sex could be a cop. But it seems like they still choose from the biggest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been pulled over. It's been a real long time since I've been pulled over by a police officer, thankfully. But yeah, I've been pulled over by some guys who were definitely on steroids, monsters. And they were probably already pretty big to begin with. I used to live next door to the guy who was an L.A. County Sheriff, and he was already a big dude. He was probably like 6 foot five, 6 foot six. And, yeah, they attract a lot of big guys, that's for sure.
What's your take on Chris's visit? Partner in crime, what did you think of his performance there? Was that something you could do? Could John Adams do that, man on the street interview with that kind of intimidation or display of masonry?
I'm not real good at man on the street type scenarios. I thought Chris did a great job. I'd just say that's probably not my forte. I'd probably start laughing. It's hard for me to keep deadpan humor. Of course, if I was just like impersonating Alex Jones the whole time, then I might be able to keep a straight face.
Yeah, Chris doesn't seem intimidated at all, which is amazing. I guess he's had first-hand experience, he says. And I guess he also probably feels he has nothing to lose because he knows he's in the right. However, I'm not sure the armed constabulary would agree with that position. It doesn't really matter who's right. They've got the firepower, and they've got the final say, no matter what you might think. But it's great that he's not intimidated in any way. I'd say he's one in a million that could do something like he did.
Yeah, I would be up for taking surveys of I could probably stand on the street and ask somebody a question like, have you ever heard of media fakery, and see what people say. That probably could be something I could do. But like I said, I get when I'm dealing with authority, I have the tendency to laugh and
You have a tendency to comply, you said?
No, I have a tendency to start laughing.
Oh, that's not good either.
Yeah, there's been instances in the past at past jobs and at you know, like back in high school, that's what would always happen. The principal would be telling me something, and then I'd start cracking up, and then I'm not taking him seriously in his alleged position of power, so then I get in even more trouble.
Yeah, that can't be good. I don't do that. I'm pretty, the advice I give when you're stopped for traffic stops, which is what I have been back when I was a little young and foolish, is I was advised by my lawyers, who I usually hired after I got a ticket, was make the stop as forgettable as possible, because when we ask for the officer's notes for cross-examination, he likely will have made none if you were just a boring, run-of-the-mill, yes-sir customer. And without recollection, he's a lousy witness, and that served me well.
Yeah, I really try hard to be respectful. I mean, at the same time, I empathize with police officers who have to go out there and do really bad work and deal with a bunch of bad people all day. And so I do have natural empathy for them, even though they might be pulling me over and doing something that they're not supposed to. And most of the time, just like everybody else, they're just doing their job. That seems to be the excuse these days. But that in of itself is accepted as a social normality. So if you were to point something out to them, like, well, yeah, you're not supposed to just do your job. You're supposed to, you know, allegedly hold up the alleged law. And when you point it out that they're not doing that, the excuse may be, well, yeah, I'm just doing my job.
Yeah, and they might not know, if they're new, all the intricacies of their job and how it became.
Yeah, there's no way they possibly could. It would be an impossibility for a police officer to know every single law on the books. That's why it negates it. That's why it's arbitrary for a police officer to pull you over and give you a ticket for something and not know that something is, that what he is doing is actually violating the law. So that is a quandary in and of itself.
But he would know if he was a Mason or a member of the Fraternal Order, sworn to uphold the oaths of said secret society first.
Yeah, and you will find a lot of police officers who are Freemasons and are pretty open about it. I remember I made a delivery to the police academy, which is pretty funny. It's in Los Angeles. There's the police academy, and that's where they actually filmed all of those comedy movies, the police academy movies, from the 1980s. And I remember I pulled in there making a delivery of ice one day, and I saw two separate vehicles with square and compasses parked in the parking lot on the back. And sometimes you'll actually see Masons like with square and compass like decals on their cars. Have you ever seen that in Canada?
Not so much. I am looking for them.
Yeah, they're becoming
look for them now.
I'll say this: like 10, 12 years ago, I never saw it. It really is a new thing in the past 10 years, maybe, that you're starting to see that more often. I'd say I would venture as far to say that I see it once a day, at least. I see somebody driving somewhere and they've got a square and compass decal or sticker on the back of their car. So it's becoming more accepted out that you wear your badge of pride as being a Mason. So,
well, somebody said that all our exposure, or all our discussion, all our talk about them is actually good advertising for them, because even though they are supposed to be a secret, we don't really know enough other than they're a secret, and if you want to find out more, dial this number here, 1-800-BE-A-MASON.
Right, and to a certain extent, I would agree with that. Like I said, I think I've told you before that I used to work at a real estate company, and pretty much both the vice presidents, not the president, but both the vice presidents of the company were Freemasons. They were pretty open about it. There was, they would hire loan officers there out of their lodge. There were guys walking around with Freemasonic rings on, and they even tried to get me to join and go to a lodge meeting. And their excuse was, well, you know so much about it already, you should just become one.
Sure.
And I would even tell them, I'm all, well, I mean, I could watch History Channel and learn all the secrets of the Masons on History Channel now. Well, there's not really much, it's not really much of a secret anymore. And when you talk to those guys who, you know, they're lower level guys, like I've said before, that they were nice people. I didn't dislike them as people, but they would go down to the lodge meeting on, you know, Thursday nights or whatever, and they'd sit around eating spaghetti dinner and drinking beer, and that's pretty much all they did.
Yeah, it is a fraternal order, and it probably has its benefits locally. And
absolutely. I doubt those guys have been out of a job in the past 6 or 7 years.
Yeah. Anyone to look out for on your famous interviews now? Anyone this week that we can look forward to or you've interviewed already? It is Wednesday, I guess.
Yeah, yesterday we interviewed Pierce Redmond, who we've interviewed before.
Okay.
And we discussed the origins of the Patriot movement and the alternative media. And we went into, unfortunately, we were having, Chris and Pierce were having some Skype difficulties. So I was only on the call for about 50 minutes, but I plan on in the future kind of doing a whole, I'd already read up on this quite a bit myself, and I kind of mentioned it in passing to Pierce just over a time period, like, oh yeah, we should talk about all the white nationalists that are, you know, just coming up out of nowhere. We should talk about the white supremacy and, like, where does that all come from? And so that's what we got into, is the origins of the Patriot Movement, the John Birch Society, and it was too brief. It would have been, if I was able to do a whole, you know, 2 or 3 hour thing on it, I really could, because I do have a lot of information as to how the Patriot Movement kind of kicked off.
Well, I think that I don't know if I talked to you about it, but I think the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, I think it is, which is, well, I think it's supposed to be a Jewish anti-hate, anti-defamation group, but it's probably just a Jesuit-funded organization of some sort, whatever the layer is, whatever one's on top of the other. And they put vigilantism on top of this year's hate group, so they win the number one top spot for the year. Or I think is it vigilantism or is it Freeman, or I can't remember. Pretty sure it began with a V. Pretty sure it was Sovereigntist.
Sovereigntist. Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, we talked about this last time we talked.
Oh, okay.
And yeah. So I have a few books that I kind of go over. I have an old book that was written in 1962. It's called The Radical Right, and it was written by a bunch of guys who were radical leftist academics. And so it was a critique of the radical right that was coming up out of nowhere. But what I realized when I was reading this book, and as I was even going over it again in preparation for the talk yesterday, was this is social engineering. That's all that it is. It's social engineering. You have the critics provide all of the memes for you. I'll give you a perfect example. In that book, this book was written in 1963, right? And it's one of the main critiques of the burgeoning, what you call the extreme right, or the John Birch Society, the Patriot Movement, and all that stuff. And what they do is they say in there, without very much evidence, they say that the radical right is a bunch of rich racist people, right? It's a bunch of rich white people who are racist. And then it provides a lot of advertising for the John Birch Society by criticizing it and using, ad hominem attacks and all sorts of things like that. Now, what it also does is it provides the impetus for people who may be bigoted to know where there's a place they can kind of go that with people who have similar ideas, and whether or not those people, like how this book is equating that, you know, rich white people who are racist are extreme right-winger John Birch Society types.
Could be a honeypot. Would you call that a honeypot? Does the CIA create these? Yeah, they create
absolutely.
These
absolutely. That's what you will find a lot of with the John Birch Society, especially in the early days, is that there was a lot of people who were in the intelligence services and even the FBI as well as the CIA were John Birch Society members and were, you know, anti-communist. I'm sure you and I have spoke about the movie JFK, you know, quite a lot of times because we were both into that at one time.
Yeah.
And you remember the Ed Asner character, Guy Bannister?
Yeah.
Okay, so he, Kevin Costner, when they're going over Guy Bannister's history, he says, oh yeah, FBI, former FBI man, John Birch Society member. And what was his job? Remember what his job was? His job was to, one day he would have, remember Lee Harvey Oswald works for him.
Right.
And one day Lee Harvey Oswald is out there passing out pro-Castro papers, and then the next week he's out there passing out anti-Castro paper.
Right, working both sides.
Yeah. And so the John Birch Society is the controlled opposition that on the opposite side, whereas the communists are the controlled opposition on the left side of the extremist spectrum. And there's always extremes provided for you as well. Like, there's always an extremist, you know, view that's there. So that can be attacked, right?
Yeah.
So I'd say for the most part, I myself, I'm not extreme about anything. I'm not vigilant about anything. I wouldn't consider myself a vigilant citizen or a, right-wing extremist or a left-wing extremist. Because extremism implies that you are, very closed-minded, that you are,
only see your way or the highway. I think as you get older, you become more moderate because, you know, nobody likes to talk to an extremist, so you may as well be moderate and just get along. It's a lot easier.
Exactly. And once you join a group that is very extreme and very, you believe in what that group thinks or you're no longer part of the group. They have these core set of ideas. Then what you are doing is you are opening yourself up for attacks, you know. And so Pierce Redman actually made a really good point yesterday during our talk. He made it after I had already gotten off the call. But he said, okay, look, the John Birch Society and the, you know, the leaders of the Patriot Movement and all this stuff, they set up these extremist groups and they set people up with the ideas already there for them to adopt. And then you will even see some of those people get tricked into doing things. And I'm not saying that Oklahoma City was a real bombing or, you know, Timothy McVeigh was a real guy who was tricked into doing stuff like that. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is there may have even been people involved in that whole thing who were part of the Patriot Movement and who were part of, you know, particular groups who did buy into it, and actually maybe they even thought like, oh, well, because, you know, they believe the kind of the mainline, either the mainline history or the mainline alternative history, they kind of think like, well, maybe that was justified in some way, or they were tricked into it like a honeypot, like by the, you know, one of the intelligence agencies. You know what I'm saying? And so,
they didn't know the ultimate deception at the end anyway, but they were there playing maybe an unwitting role, not knowing fully that this building was just going to be portrayed as blown up and people died, but they wouldn't be any of the wiser because they would probably not be there at the very, very end when the simulation took place.
Absolutely.
Hello, everybody. I joined you in calling, and I just caught you in the middle of the conversation there, so I want to say hello to you, Ab, and hello to John Adams. It's Unreal on the phone.
Oh, hello.
Oh, hi, Unreal. So, yeah, I was going to introduce you, but yeah, Unreal from Paris, I invited him into the call. John, I hope you don't mind, but he wanted to maybe say a few words to you.
I was just going to say I was listening to the show, actually, with John Adams and Chris and Redmond, and according to what John said there, I think another factor here would be that when you play two extreme sides on a population, they will actually be inactive afterwards because you take away all the motives to any tendency and you actually deactivate them, a little bit like dogs around a herd. They will stay in the herd when the dogs bark on both sides, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
That's true because what you will find with all of those groups, whatever group it is that you join, you'll find that they don't really accomplish their goals. If you go back and watch the old original reel-to-reels, which you can find on YouTube now, of Robert Welch talking when the John Birch Society first started, the goal of the John Birch Society, the stated goal, is to eliminate communism from the earth. Okay. All right? So we're talking about an outlandish goal there already because how are you going to do that?
Well, it's a little bit like you said in the show about the G's turning up all the time in the Birch Society. Maybe the eliminate is also the reference to Illuminati, you know, just an inside joke somehow.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's what I was kind of alluding to. And Tim hasn't heard the call yet, but Tim, you've heard of G. Edward Griffin before, right?
Yeah, I have. I think he was one of the first 9/11 books or something. He was.
That's suspicious in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, he was one of the first guys.
Yeah,
he's
a very old he's a very old guy who got his start with the John Birch Society.
Okay.
Way back in the 60s, and now he does something called Freedom Force International. But in doing a little bit of pre-research before I talked on that call yesterday, I came across something really strange that there is an overabundance of guys who call themselves G something who are John Birch Society members.
Okay, is that a Masonic tribute putting the G there?
That's what I'm thinking. But it would be like if you just started calling yourself G Tim Adams. G. Aberrato, yeah. Or I'm now G. John Adams. Right?
Yeah, maybe that's what the brothers say when they say, "What's up, G?"
I think that's why that's in hip hop. Most definitely, is they call each other G and.
Yeah, I never knew what G meant. I thought it meant for. Yeah, I just remember hearing
it. But they are big on numbers and also on language. So if you go in and look at the theories about how they actually coded language with numbers, for sure they would use that as some private signs between them, you know?
Absolutely. And, sure. And the word that describes that particular phenomenon also starts with a G.
Gematria.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Zach Hubbard, the world-famous gematria person. Maybe we should. Maybe if he listens to this call, he can break down some of the numerology in our discussion. He's good at it.
Yeah, but here is more like a little bit like Chris has talked about on his calls, and I think it's prevalent, is the duper's delight that these people actually encourage through their activities. And I think they really feel superior. And they use this those little pranks to play on us, because you need to feel superior to actually go through with all their plans, you know?
Yes.
You need confidence.
Yeah, I also think, too, that, you know, I've tried my best to articulate this. I'm not very good at it. But, you see, a lot of these people, they're involved with organizations that are pushing the idea of change within society. And so when you talk about someone being under mind control involved in one of these operations, I wouldn't speak to it as someone being under mind control like, oh, I'm some mind control patsy like, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald or something like that. I'm not, you know, that's not what I'm alluding to. I'm saying that these people are under social mind control, where they believe that by carrying out these events that that the change in society is going to be good.
Yeah.
As a result of what they are doing, which that is cult behavior, that is mind control behavior.
It's for the greater good.
I'm not sure if I would agree that they have this benevolent, ambition.
Why wouldn't you agree with that?
Because they have a very negative opinion of the population as a whole when they feel themselves in the place to actually mislead us, so we have a life without meaning. That's very cruel.
Sure. The people I was referring to would be the actual people who would get maybe employed into carrying out the actual event. And
okay,
I wouldn't think that about a world leader or someone like that. That's not who I'm talking about. But I would venture to
more
say
the structure
that
underneath.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like if you took a no name bureaucrat you're calling from France.
Yeah, I am.
Okay. So you are in the you are swimming in bureaucrats.
I am.
Okay, right now you are swimming in bureaucrats over there. So I would venture to say that there are bureaucrats who work in the socialist French government who believe that the public needs to be governed and that they are doing a good thing by socially engineering them.
Yeah, and even further, maybe they are so compartmentalized that they are only aware of the benefits of their little action, and they don't really have the big picture, and they might believe as much in dinosaurs as any other person.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I know people personally who just work in local Los Angeles bureaucratic positions, not per se in city government or anything like a social worker or someone who is appointed by the court to help drug addicts or those type of things, right?
Yeah.
The people in those positions really believe in the power of the state. And
yeah, I agree completely with you on that level. Yeah.
Yeah, and so what they do, like even if you were to suggest to them, like oh well. There might even be a possibility that someone who, like, let's say I wanted to open my own drug rehabilitation center, and I could do a good job of helping someone out psychologically and help get them off drugs. No. The state does that, and people get employed by the state because the government is supposed to do that, not you. You don't have a PhD. You don't have a license. You don't have any of that stuff. You're not going to be able to do that.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, so they're
not sanctioned by the state.
No, they believe in the power of the state, and they believe in the idea that if you've got the right kind of licensing, then you're going to be able to do that. And that's what I mean. Like people who are involved in these type of events, they have on lower levels, they have a very optimistic view. I think that they think that out of this is going to come some good. And there's gonna, we're gonna be able to get rid of guns, and we're gonna be able to change people's opinions about, people's perception.
And they're all noble.
So how would you put, the people, involved in like school shootings and that kind of events where there is actual violence and much grief, and it's very hard to see the positive sides of such contrivances somehow? Would you have an opinion on how they will have that many people involved in those events, and they all believing it's for the better cause?
Yeah, I'm familiar with one case. I remember this specifically, and I even have the newspaper article from it. But there was, I think, a school in Bakersfield, California, where it was blatantly obvious that they faked an active shooter. I don't know if you guys remember this particular case, but they were having a school drill. They're having a school drill, and then all of a sudden, like everybody's supposed to go back to class, and it was an active shooter drill. And then they just told everybody, oh, yeah, the drill went live and there was a shooter, but nobody died or, you know, like something like that. Like there was a shooter and he was going to shoot some people, but he didn't actually kill anybody or something like that. Or maybe somebody allegedly got injured or something. It was something real light.
He didn't kill anybody. Anybody knows, so don't worry about it.
Right. So what happens with a lot of this type of stuff, too, and I was recently going over some old newspapers that I had saved. I don't know if you guys remember that there was a shooting in Santa Monica at Santa Monica City College, like 2 years ago.
Is that where the young kid was trying to crush on somebody or something?
Yeah, and he said his house.
Guy?
Yeah. Oh no. That was a different one. That was a different one.
No.
But this one, this guy allegedly set his house on fire, burned up his family, and then he went on a shooting spree, and he was able to shoot off 3,300 rounds.
3,300.
Yeah, 3,300 rounds. Okay.
The magic number every time.
And then his last name just happened to be, you got to think of the time period. This is 2 years ago, so this is right before they switched from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. Al-Qaeda's still in the mix.
Yeah.
The guy's Al-Qaeda. Name, the shooter's name was John Zawahiri.
Oh,
okay.
I always said John was very suspicious back then.
Okay, so the point I was making was that I think that a lot of these when you have these things happen in a local type thing where like maybe the FBI doesn't get involved some big agency doesn't necessarily get involved in these things, these people are clamoring for money.
Funding, yeah.
Yeah, they're looking for funding. And they have no qualms about doing anything like that because they're thinking, well, this is good because we're going to be able to get our own tank and we're going to be able to get, body armor and helmets and everything else. So that
the problem with that would be that once the money is not there anymore, it's like then they would have no big incentive not to speak about it somehow, wouldn't you think?
No,
yeah,
they're in a brotherhood.
But Tim just pointed out right before you got on, and rightly so, that these events fade so quickly from the public memory. They're in and out just like that. I mean, I guarantee you if I talk to somebody on the street here and I ask them about, remember, if I ask them the question I just asked you guys, do you remember the shooting at Santa Monica College 2 years ago? They're not going to know what I'm even talking about.
Even if they're in Santa Monica, they'll forget.
Yeah, exactly.
And what real reporters would there be anyhow to go around and ask questions, right?
Absolutely.
Oh, well, I would be weird that I actually remembered it. That's the thing. They're going to be like, you remember that?
I don't follow the news as much since some time, so it's like I know that it would be normal for me not to know about a lot of events, but... I do think that they have a plan to make us have very short attention spans, and I think the Pavlovian school bell is the sign they knew of this very early on, and now with the text messaging and the emails and all these sounds, they are probably very aware of the fact that attention spans are getting lower.
Yes, I agree. I agree. That's why I try to read as much as possible. One, because I enjoy it, but two, I know that I find myself even slipping too, where I don't watch any television at all, don't have a television in my house, and I can see it within myself. And so I know if I can see something within myself, it must be happening to a greater extreme with other people who do have television and who are involved in the modern culture. And
but do you read newspaper then, or to know of all these news events?
No, actually, I only go to a couple of sites, and that's about it. I don't keep up with the regular news at all. I never see any newspapers. Like I said, I have when I was referring to that Santa Monica College shooting, it was interesting. because I had to do a delivery over right by the college, like the week after the shooting happened. So I grabbed a couple of the local newspapers there and I saved them, and that's the only reason I had those. But yeah, the one of the things that I think is at least for myself is interesting is if you let something play out and you don't get caught up in the media hype, because I've been in the past, I've been guilty of this just as much as anybody else, because you know, I used to listen to Alex Jones, and you listen to Alex Jones, and Alex Jones is talking about the news of the day, and he is hyping you up on the news of the day, and you're getting wrapped up and involved, and it's almost like a soap opera, because you want to tune in and the next day, you want to see the newspaper the next day to see what's happening in the economy, see what's happening with the current state of the war, or whatever it may be. But if you let events play out, and then you go look at them in hindsight, you'll actually see a lot more than you would if you were keeping up with them on a day-to-day basis, because you're blinded by the hype.
Of course, it's also the fact that they are able to, a little bit as you hint at, to stir up your emotion, which makes you a very bad decision maker and very poor to see the objective facts, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you're, like you just said, your emotions get stirred up, and that's a very interesting thing in of itself, because when your emotions are going all sorts of different ways, you can be easily twisted and turned, and then later on you go, man, I can't even believe that I actually thought that way about this particular thing. You know, you have to reflect on it, and you go back and you realize all of the twists and turns that you took within your mind.
It's incredible for me to look back at all the alternative research I was really deep into, and to see how little I actually really thought independently of it, and just went with the emotion it probably provoked in me.
Yeah.
And Alex Jones is one of those, you know, media figures who is really good at stirring up emotion. And I never followed Alex Jones for very long because I thought he was annoying straight away I saw him, and I didn't. It's probably working much better for Americans somehow. I'm not sure, but
Absolutely.
He really gets people, you know, moving in some ways. Like he stirs up their mind.
Yeah, he definitely is. I've talked about this on past calls with Chris, but he appeals to a particular type of American that, and they might even have people like this in France, because I have a particular like for French films and French music, and I'll just say this real quick. One of my favorite all-time music artists is Django Reinhardt, right?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so I love French music. I like French culture. I like a lot of stuff having to do with France. But one thing I do know about France is any particular given generation, like I remember watching French films from the 90s, and there was even things in French films from the 90s talking bad about globalization and how all the jobs in France were being, you know, shipped abroad, right?
Yeah.
And I think that France, to a certain extent, is even more hip to a lot of things of that nature than Americans would be. Like, you couldn't come up to an average American, they're going to know what globalization is. They don't know what that is. Right.
Yeah, we ponder a little bit about those relationships between the United States and France and England earlier on. It could seem like France is being played like the bad cop and the United States the good cop. Like France comes in and do the exact opposite that you know the English American alliance would do. So
yeah.
It just seems a little bit scripted too, the difference of France, you know. It seems like it's working very well for the tension that it can build sometimes in the Occidental countries.
Yeah, it really is a, like I said, I've done a brief I'm not.
Because, John, didn't you mention one time that the wine industry is also somewhat invented?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that France is wine, you know. So it's like it's. I would really like to. I don't know if you remember the book title and author you mentioned regarding the wine story, but I found that very interesting.
Yeah, the book is called Gallo, G-A-L-L-O.
Right.
Gallo, Be Thy Name.
Okay, I'm writing it down.
Yeah, Gallo, Be Thy Name. I don't know who the author is offhand.
No, but that would be found. It's a very specific title.
Yeah, it'll be real easy.
Mentioned the wine.
Is that the guy who said there will be no wine before it's time? Ernst Gallo?
That's right, Ernest and Giulio Gallo. That's right, yeah.
I'm right? Oh, right. The propaganda worked on me. That was a slogan. I love slogans and jingles.
That's right. Yeah, the billionaires of cheap wine.
Wow.
But what I was getting at is there is a particular type of, for lack of a better word, programming for France.
Yeah.
That is much different than the programming for America when it comes to patriotism, when it comes to nationalism. They are very similar to a certain extent. But Alex Jones really does appeal to a type of person who looks at something like something was lost. Like there was this America and at one time it existed like this. And if we can just get back to that, then everything's going to be okay. And this, is what you would call a golden age thinking.
Hmm.
That's a very
common politic. They often refer to like the good times. The politicians are good at that. Like bring up
good old days. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And what's interesting is this was actually put into one of Woody Allen's films. It's actually called Midnight in Paris. You ever seen that flick?
Yeah, I think I saw it. It was with many couples, or wasn't it? No, I'm mistaken. I think.
It's a movie about a guy who's a writer, and then as he's walking through Paris, he time travels back to the 1920s. And,
yeah, I didn't see it because I kind of suspect Woody Allen to be quite, controlled.
Woody Allen, though. I love Woody Allen, but I don't know if I've seen that one.
The point he was trying to get across, because you find this if you do actually go and read some of the authors from the 1920s who were in Paris, like the Americans who lived in Paris after the war, you find them longing for those old days again, right? They're very nostalgic.
Yeah.
Well, and, who isn't nostalgic, really, John, honestly?
Everybody
is. Yeah, once you get to a certain age, you're nostalgic. I don't know. It might be 10.
Right. Absolutely. The danger with nostalgia, as we can see in our own current cultures, all three of us, Canada, France, and America, is that nostalgia can be used to keep you in a state of arrested development.
Yeah. Good point.
And or it can be used to evoke patriotism and nationalism because, like I said, people become nostalgic about something. If you're living in France and you're starting to see too many brown people instead of French people, you might become nostalgic for the France that used to exist.
Yeah.
You know, same thing if you're starting to see too many Asians in Canada. That might anger somebody. And then, you know, out here in California, we just get everybody. So
right.
that might make someone might long for the good old days and then decide that, oh, I'm mad because there's too many Pakistanis living in my neck of the woods. So I'm going to get mad about it. I'm going to go, you know, join Le Pen.
Le Pen. Yeah, it's called Le Pen.
Le Pen. Yeah.
And now his daughter is in there too. Yeah.
Yeah, she's obviously controlled opposition. Absolutely.
Yeah, as we kind of suspect here, it's like politics is theater, and many of the conflicts are very created. I found something very simplistic, but it looks so, I'm speaking English and French, so it's like when it comes to Germany, if you just split that word in two and you have many and you have jeu, and jeu is guerre, so it's many wars, you know? So it's like, it's nailed like the script, that whole country, from the beginning when they created the Germany out of the Prussian republics. It's like they already had planned in ahead that country was going to be made to produce a lot of wars in Europe.
Right. And what's...
That's very good.
On that note, if you take the word Russia, Russia is Rus, which is red, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Perfect for communists.
Yeah, it just so happens that the country that whose name means red just happens to become the red communist.
Yeah, it's
no coincidence, right?
So that really rejoins how they create these characteristics and also then later makes appeal to it through nostalgia also. So it's like it's nearly frightening to think about how much is really thought about on beforehand when it comes down to it, what you said about Russia there. That's incredible.
Yeah. I'm wondering what's going to happen to Canada, since if you take the word Canada, it actually means canyon in Spanish.
Yeah, but it's an Indian word though. It's an native Indian word, like all the non-British or a few French origin names of cities and counties up here, all native. They're all native. So Canada, some, I don't know what it means, and what is Iroquois or the Huron Indians or the Sioux. There's a bunch of Indians around the Great Lakes. I think they were the ones that got where they took that name from. Maybe it's the land of many lakes. I don't know what it means. But, yeah, it might mean something in Spanish, too.
Yeah, Kenyatta. is how they say it in Spanish, and that means a canyon, like under, kind of like a canyon under a mountain, kind of.
Yeah, I think it means in Spanish, place up north to pick fruit and vegetables.
That's actually what it does mean.
Well, let's be thankful for them. Yeah, go ahead.
Gentlemen, I have enjoyed this international call. I always enjoy speaking to Tim, and I really enjoyed speaking to you, Unreal. We should talk again sometime soon. I have to go right now. It's dinner time.
Yeah, with great pleasure. So I must commend you for all the great entertainment I enjoyed with you and Chris and all your invites. So yeah, thanks.
Well, thank you for listening. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, John. Good job, as always.
Yeah, very good. Very good. So
great. Well, if you guys continue the conversation, then I will check it out on the flip side, as I like to say.
All right. Have a great day.
Yeah, have a great day, John.
Yeah, you take it easy, guys. Bye.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
There goes John Adams of HoaxBustersCall.com. Check him out. He's a one-man or... 50% or one half of HoaxBustersCall.com with Chris Kendall, and he's the ringman. He's the one that ropes in all the guests that talk to Chris, for the most part, I believe, and really interesting stuff, Unreal.
Yeah, I think John Adams and Chris Kendall together, they make a very good pair of researchers with the multifaceted way of approaching the different stories. So, yeah, for sure, they do produce a lot of good shows.
Yeah, together they know a lot of stuff. They know a lot
of really,
stuff.
Yeah, really, they do.
It's phenomenal, really, how much they know. And John is so well-read, and Chris knows about everything, it seems, and it's a pretty good 1-2 punch when they bring on a guest. There's not too many guests that can pull fast one over these two and their knowledge.
Yeah, and I think it's good that like they open up to have a different kind of researchers with them on their shows, talking about subjects that are not always so much talked about. It's very enlightening.
Yeah, and the criticism I've heard ever since I started my show is, oh, everyone you have on is a shill. Okay, well, yeah. Everyone has an agenda. We all agree with that. I have a 9/11 agenda, and it's morphing into a NASA hoax agenda. And everyone's controlled opposition. Well, I'm not so sure everyone's controlled opposition in the sense that I don't think everyone's paid to do what they're doing. I know I'm not paid. Now, I might be mind-controlled into my position, but I don't think, well, I know I'm not paid, and I'm not sure most of these guys that come on are paid in any way. So I'm not sure that's very fair. That's a good way of dismissing people.
Yeah, and even though the people are in that segment of the opposition, they do contribute to the general debate. So it's like we cannot exclude that debate if it's on an intelligent level. And some of the researchers, I think we will never know if they are contrived or not, because they are keep coming up with good material.
Well, they make us talk, and I think we're all smart enough at this point to figure out who's trying to fool us, who's on the good side, and who's on the bad side. And as we've talked about before, you need an evil to have a good. And if these guys are on the wrong side, I'm pretty sure we're all pretty smart by now to figure out who's screwing us and who's telling us what's the truth. I don't think any of us at this stage have any problem discerning.
Yeah, at least for speaking for myself, I must say that what I do not appreciate is when I feel that the controlled opposition is really obvious and kind of annoying putting good research down. You know, if it's that kind of opposition, I'm not so much for it. But if it's contributions to a debate that's open, I need to look into it. It's important. I need to know what the opposition is coming with too. So it's like that's the only difference I make for myself to decide whether this is contributing to the discussion in the general or if it's just lowering the debate. You know,
the debasing the debate. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, debasing. Right, well, that's much better.
Yeah, well, I have a few English words up my sleeve. If I can't speak English, I can't speak anything. At least if you can't speak English, you can say, well, I can speak 5 other languages, so I got nothing on you. But I want to.
Well, what happens sometimes is like you speak none of the languages, you speak very well, and that's what's happened with me. I don't speak any good French, English, Norwegian, or anything. But I'm trying to keep up thinking.
Yeah, but you know what? You can talk to so many more people than I can. Although, of course, people are forced to speak English globally if they want to get ahead, they're told. But
Think language changes the way you express your ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So when you would talk another language, like you kind of know French, you probably understand French pretty well. So you go to France, you would probably really feel the different mentality when you actually speak the language as well.
Yeah, I suppose.
So
well, let me wrap this conference call up, because the audio quality is never as good as TeamSpeak, because it goes through the POTS, the plain old telephone system. So the fidelity is often lost, and the bandwidth and bit rate is lower. So we'll wrap it up, because we do create these conference calls for people like John who cannot hook up via the internet for whatever reason. And I can meet Unreal or anyone else who wants to continue listening. Although we have no listeners live to this call anyway. It is not hooked up to the audio stream, but it will be posted tomorrow. So if you want Unreal, I can meet you at audio chat, or I know it's late for you, so maybe you want to find
Yeah, out. It's getting late for me too, and I was really happy to be invited to speak to both of you. And
yeah.
I'm
glad
will as yeah, exactly. You challenged me a bit there, so I said, okay, I haven't done it before, so I'll try it, and it worked pretty fine. It's actually a little bit different to sit in front of a telephone only and not a screen and talk. It's getting a little bit more personal, actually, so it's like it was a good experience.
Yeah, there you go. So there's phone numbers for almost every civilized, if you call them civilized, countries of the world for this free conference call, hd.com. So there's no excuse for not talking. You can, by the way, anyone listening, you can start your own fakeologist conference call. There's two access numbers. One is a host and one is a participant. If you want to host it, you can host it yourself. The only thing you won't be able to do is get the audio file. I'll have to get it because it's my account. But I'll take the audio file and process it and post it. And we've had at least one person do that, and that was on Install Media. Good job on Install. So it is possible, and it does work. So anyone who wants to try that, give it a whirl. So we'll sign off now and thank John Adams and Unreal. And we'll catch
thank you,
Adam. John says, on the flip side. Take care.
Take care.
Hi, this is Errol C., and you're listening to Fakeologist Radio.